This is Business of Home. I'm your host, Dennis Scully. Every week, I'll be talking with leaders and innovators from all corners of the home industry. My guest this week is Bob King, the founder and CEO of ergonomic furniture brand, HumanScale. Bob founded his company in the early 1980s, just as personal computers were becoming common in the office, and workers had no idea how to sit properly to use them. Now his company, which today supplies chairs to corporations like Apple and Google, finds itself at another pivot point as millions of Americans look for ways to make working from home work for them. I spoke with Bob about what it takes to make a good home office, the challenge of designing a good-looking ergonomic chair, and what designers can do to push for real sustainability from their manufacturers. This podcast is sponsored by luxury home retailer Ben Sulmani. Ben Sulmani is home to an incredible selection of in-stock and ready-to-ship luxury home furnishings, rugs, and textiles, including oversized rugs, both contemporary and antique. Iconic design, bespoke quality, and unparalleled craftsmanship. BenSulmani.com seamlessly creates an all-inclusive luxury showroom experience at your fingertips. Courtesy is given to the trade with a designated site and pricing. Visit BenSulmani.com or stop by the West Hollywood showrooms to learn more. This episode is also sponsored by Sidedoor. Designer, Sidedoor is a game-changing tool that helps you transform your business and become more profitable. It features a thriving online marketplace for designers only, where you can buy direct from the top trade brands at your price and let someone else handle the logistics. Sidedoor also features a powerful sales tool that lets you curate shoppable collections from your favorite vendors and share them on social media, your website, or directly with your clients. Find out more at onsidedoor.com. That's onsidedoor.com. And now, on with the show. I want to get a sense from you, because your particular business experienced the change because of COVID in a very different way than some other businesses might have. But I wonder if you can take me back a little bit to maybe it's March of 2020, when suddenly this sort of unprecedented number of people are suddenly forced to work from home, and how that began to show up in your business, what that looked like. You were so used to catering to an office-based contract designer client, and I'm guessing that suddenly you started to see a move in your business in a very different way.
Right. Well, it was pretty traumatic for us. We do probably at that point, we probably did 90% of our sales revenue through large corporations around the world, and they closed pretty much every office around the world. So it wasn't a great time for us at all, Dennis.
And I'm sorry to bring those memories back, Bob.
It was quite painful. Thanks for that. No, what was interesting, of course, is that our residential business tripled, which was, you know, a very positive thing and a very predictable thing. And what we saw, of course, is that people were buying things for their home. Lots of times they didn't know what to buy for their home, but they would buy a really nice chair, but they didn't have a workstation, and they were sitting with a chair at a workstation that was, you know, way too high or way too low. And so we ended up partnering with a lot of our customers, the likes of Google and some of the large banks and so on, in providing in their employees work from home solutions that were thoughtful and considered. And so we put together microsites for customers like that, and allowing employees to do the right thing for home. So home has become an enormous issue for us, and we've really switched a lot of our focus from corporate workplace to residential workplace and just residential overall. So we're in both places now.
Well, and it's interesting, because I think that we found out that there was actually a lot to learn about this space. There was a lot to learn about what is a good chair for us to have to work from home at. And you, in an interesting way, sort of, and we're going to talk about this in a bit, but you sort of experienced in your career this moment when computers were first showing up in offices years ago, and sort of all the problems or the confusion that went along with that. And then suddenly here you were in a place and time when people were bringing computers home and working from the kitchen table or working from their children's bed a lot of the time, and trying to work from wherever they could. And the challenges that went along with that, and you had sort of an array of products and knowledge that could help make that easier for them.
And that's exactly right. It's very interesting. Exactly what we were seeing in the beginning in the 80s, where people didn't know what to do in an office to create a healthy workstation, we're seeing that actually even more so at home. Because in the office, at least they have a desk that's at the right height, right, and a reasonable chair. But they still made a mess of it. But at home, they don't. They probably have a dining room chair, and you don't know what kind of work surface. We have photographs of people working in the craziest ways at home, and it's I think the problems we had in the office are going to be dwarfed by what we see of people at home, and that's why a lot of companies are getting involved to try to help people make thoughtful decisions for their home or their homework.
At our Future of Home conference, one of the panelists used the term clofus as a place where many people were working, a combination closet office, where so many people were forced to either hide from small children while they were trying to take video calls or just find a quiet place. So as you say, people were working in sort of crazy conditions at home for the past year and a half.
Yeah, no, that's right. We've seen people working in laundry rooms doing sit stand on the washer machine. literally, I mean, friends of mine have done it, and it's quite interesting.
Well, I'm fascinated by it, and I'm also fascinated by this notion of trying to figure out a very different customer and sort of how you have to sort of retrofit your business. Tell me a little bit about who your sort of main client base was pre-COVID. Help me understand who your customers were. Were they contract interior designers? Were they big firms? You mentioned Google. Was it these big tech firms that would just be coming to you directly?
Well, they're all any large company. They were primarily larger companies because that's what we're set up for. And they're the ones who can afford our stuff. I mean, our stuff is not inexpensive. We find smaller companies would be a tighter budget and would get less expensive stuff. So we work with all the large tech companies, Google, Apple, Salesforce, and so on, but all the big banks and so on, Chase, Citibank, Wells Fargo, Verizon, AT&T. We work with, you know, most large companies. The reason we do and the reason that we exist is we're very innovative. If we didn't, we wouldn't exist, because it's much easier to buy everything from your contract furniture supplier, the Herman Millers or Steelcases of the world, and just get everything from them. So whatever we do has to be significantly better than what they have to offer. So that's how we exist, and that's the nature of our business.
Well, so let's talk about that a little bit, because you just mentioned some very big competitors in Steelcase and Herman Miller, and Herman Miller recently acquired Knoll and has become, I'm guessing, a sort of an even more formidable competitor, perhaps. And I'm wondering how you have been able to sort of compete against those big companies. You talk about innovation. Tell me a little bit about that.
Well, we believe in simplicity from a design point of view. We want things to be simple visually, but we also want them to be simple in terms of how you use them. In the office, people are sitting in chairs, desk chairs, that have all kinds of manual controls that allow them to do things as simple as lean back in their chair for a while. So you'd lean back and you'd read a document or talk on the phone or talk to a fellow worker. And you could adjust the tension on these chairs to fit your body weight by turning a knob typically underneath the chair. And if you wanted to lean back, you have to operate a control, and then you have to lean forward to get your weight off the backrest, and then you could lean back. It's just crazy. And so I figured, all right, we'll design a chair that's easy to use. And I went through a dozen or more designers who had designed chairs for the big furniture companies and told them about this problem. Chairs are too complicated. People don't know how to do something as simple as lean back or adjust the recline force on the darn thing. and no one really knew what I was talking about or how to deal with it. And so I was almost about to give up on this concept. And then someone said, oh, you should talk to Niels Diffrandt. He's probably the greatest living chair designer in the world. So I called up Niels Diffrandt in the mid-90s. We were a small company. He never heard of us. But I just called him up and I told him about this problem. And he said, oh, okay. And I said, we're looking for someone to design a chair, you know, that's easier to use. I didn't know what that meant. But so I went up to visit with him. It turns out he lived in Ridgefield, Connecticut. It's just an hour and a half from where I am in New York City. And I drove up there. I told him about this problem. And at one point, he said, you know, Bob, come with me. I want to show you something I've been working on for a bit. And so I went into another room there. It was his prototype shop. And he had a prototype of a chair. And he said, sit down. And I did. And he said, go ahead and lean back. And of course, I knew how chairs work. They have locks and tension adjustment. And so I feel for the recline lock. And he said, forget that, Bob, just lean back. And I did. And it held me up. And I leaned back some more and it held me up. And I sat up and it held me up. And I didn't have to operate controls to do that, which sounds pretty normal. But in reality, no other chair ever made allowed you to do that. And so we end up, Niels and I became very, very good friends. He became one of my closest friends. And we developed four chairs together over the next 20 years. And so with our chairs, if you have 1,000 people in an office, 1,000 people come in, sit in their chairs, perfectly adjusted for their body weight when they sit down in them. And they didn't have to go to chair training, didn't have to do the webinar on how to use the darn chair. And they can just move from one position to another without thinking about it. So now Miller and Steelcase are just introducing chairs that do that sort of thing. We would say they don't do it nearly as well, of course. And that's what we've been doing for 20 some years now.
Well, so this is what I'm curious about. One of the challenges that designers are facing right now is the challenge that they used to face years ago with the reclining chair. So all their clients would say, oh, my husband, you're not going to like this, but he wants a reclining chair with the ottoman. And every designer just cringed and said, they're all hideous. They're all horrible. No, you can't have that. And so now everyone is working from home and they need a really good office chair. And I'm sure you must be thinking about what modifications do we need to make to this somewhat futuristic looking sometimes or officey looking piece of furniture. How do we make this look more at home in a residential environment?
Right. Well, there is a difference. We want to make sure our products aren't technical looking. It makes sense to make products that are appropriate for people's homes because offices have moved very much in that direction. So that's a main focus of ours for a number of years now to do that.
So conveniently, you were already moving in that direction and thinking that way because so many offices were trying to look more home-like in some of their spaces, yes?
Yes, that's right. Offices, for quite some time, it's been a trend that's been going on for 10 years or more of making offices warmer, more welcoming. I think it actually was started with the WeWork movement where WeWork had these places where they had couches all over the place and so on. And I think it's been a very healthy thing. I think it's a very positive movement.
We're taking a quick break from the show to learn more about Sidedoor, the online marketplace for the trade only. Designers, here are three ways Sidedoor can help you level up your firm. 1, you can create a free account and instantly get access to trade pricing from top brands without having to worry about order minimums. 2, you can rely on Sidedoor's logistic team to handle customer service and make sure the product arrives on time. And 3, you can curate a collection, share it on your website or social media, and earn 30% when your followers buy through you. It's all part of Sidedoor's mission to make designers more profitable in the digital age. Sign up today at onsidedoor.com. That's onsidedoor.com. And now, back to the show. earlier you said that residential retail was only 10% of your business. I'm assuming it's a much larger percent of your business now. Are you imagining that going forward, your business is going to become one that is just as focused on home as it is on the office?
Oh, absolutely. That doesn't mean, you know, that we're going to be making couches anytime soon. We almost certainly won't. But for the products that we make, we want to make sure when we come up with a new product, like a chair, that it's appropriate in an office as well as a home. And again, fortunately, those two areas are coming together. The office is moving much more closer to a residential look, which is very cool. And I think the office is a much more pleasant place to be as a result of it.
Well, exactly. And that's part of what I want to talk about. We all do need to accept that this is likely going to be the future, this hybrid model and this home office that we might have just quickly thrown together is actually going to be a place where we might be coming 2 or 3 days a week, perhaps for the rest of our lives. And so we need to make it far more functional in many cases than it might be right now. And I'm wondering what you think are some of the critical elements that a home office should really have and sort of how you're guiding residential interior designers in terms of how to think about this going forward.
Look, it's important that you have the ability to adjust your work to you. So it's really important that I think ideally you want to have a work surface that's adjustable, that can move. And you need a chair that allows you to move freely from one position to another. You're probably in a situation where you probably need a light as well, because if you're working with paper at the same time as using a computer, if you don't have a light, that can cause problems. So, because ideally you don't want a very brightly lit room when you're working on the computer. So those are three basic things you really want to have at home. How you do it is very different, because at home, a lot of times people have a lot of space, but more often they probably have very little space. So that's really where it becomes a challenge. If you can make a room an office, we can do a lot there, right? But if you don't have a room that you can dedicate as an office, then it becomes a bit more challenging. So that's when you have to figure out what kind of work surface do you end up with, and what kind of compromises do you make in terms of space?
Right, because that's going to be the big challenge, is how do we make this feel part of the home?
Right, how does it feel part of the home and actually enhance the way the home looks? If you do it well, it can have a beautiful office.
And I think that is going to be in real estate listings very soon. Beautiful home office, right? In the same way that we used to talk about how the kitchen had been recently renovated or the bathroom, right? Now I think a home office is going to be a very important part.
Yeah, well, I have friends who've looked for temporary homes on VRBO and that sort of thing. And they're saying that's in almost every VRBO listing does it have a workstation at home or not?
Well, as you said earlier, I mean, it must seem funny to you in a way that you're going through this same thing that you went through when you first founded the company. Tell us a little bit about the early days and founding Human Scale and sort of where you came from originally and how it sort of evolved into the company that you started.
Well, like after business school, I was working for a large computer company selling computers, a company called Digital Equipment, which isn't around anymore, but at the time it was the second largest computer company in the world. And so I realized I always thought it would be wonderful to have my own business and run a business the way I thought it should be run, where you care about the environment, where you care about people. And so I saw it as an opportunity, and I started the company in end of 1982, beginning of 83. And it's been fun. I work with designers, product designers from all over the world, developing, cool stuff. And it's been a wonderful, wonderful, joyful journey. I must say, I'm very, very fortunate that I am able to do this.
You mentioned the environment, and I know that that's an important issue for you. I know that you consider yourself an environmentalist and a conservationist, and tell me a little bit about how that care and that concern sort of weaves its way into your business, and let's move in the direction of sustainability and have that conversation.
Yeah, sure. I've always been a conservationist. I've had a relationship with the World Wildlife Fund since the 90s, and ever since I was a kid, I loved being outdoors. I loved wildlife. I just think it's incredibly important that we leave a wonderful, diverse planet to our children. It's not easy to do that. We're not headed in the right direction. So I've always, as a company, HumanScale has always been committed to protecting the environment, to doing the right thing. So we pioneered things like using healthy materials very early on. We worked really hard to get rid of any what are called red listed chemicals from our products. Red listed chemical is a euphemism for a carcinogen, either a carcinogen when you use it, or it's a carcinogen upstream or downstream in the supply chain. So, you know, as a company, we don't use chrome 6, we don't use formaldehyde, we don't use any PVCs, and we're the only company in the industry that doesn't use those things. For example, if you buy a desk from us, height adjustable desk, you don't have to worry if it has formaldehyde in it that will off gas. Pretty much any desk you buy anywhere will be made with formaldehyde. But if you buy one from HumanScale, there's no formaldehyde in it, so it doesn't off-gas.
So what are some examples of healthy materials? What are some of the materials that you use that don't contain all these horrible things? Because truthfully, you start to look under the hood of what most of our furniture is made of these days, and it's pretty frightening.
No, it is. In fact, along with using healthy materials, we pioneered transparency. So 85% of our products now have ingredients labels. There's two standard ingredients labels. One's called HPD, the other's called Declare. And they have all the ingredients all the way back in your supply chain, which takes a bit of research. And if it's red listed, it's red, right? So it stands out. There's no mistaking it. And we represent about 4% of the industry by revenue. And yet we had 70% of the ingredients labels. I'm happy to say that now we've told our customers using healthy materials is important and here's why, but you can't make a considered decision about using healthy materials unless you know what the heck's in your product. So ask your other suppliers for ingredients labels so you can make a thoughtful decision about that. And so they've been asking their other suppliers, and now we're about 25% of all the ingredients labels in the industry, which is terrific because the other suppliers have gone ahead and provided ingredients labels. And in doing that, they've gotten the red listed chemicals out of their products because you can't have an ingredients label on a product and have carcinogens in it. So it's been a very positive thing. Certain companies like Google, for example, now will only buy product that have an ingredient label associated with it. The sad thing, unfortunately, is that there's a lot of what we call greenwashing out there where companies do what's convenient and put a bit of a marketing message together saying, oh, isn't this great? We've used recycled plastic or our product can be recycled, thinking that that's making a difference. And that kind of confusion actually pushes the needle in the wrong direction. It doesn't allow people to make the right decisions even when they're trying to do something that's meaningful.
Well, so help me understand that a little bit better. So what's the concern there? I can't think of a company that's not trying to say they've got something that's been made of recycled materials or that everything that they produce will ultimately be recyclable. But as it all depends on whether or not someone's going to actually recycle them, right? And whether that's really going to happen.
Yeah, no, that's right. It depends on whether or not it's going to be recycled. But that's only a small part of it. The fact is, just because something is recyclable, and pretty much everything is recyclable if you put enough work into it, but if you throw something out, unless it's valuable, made out of a metal that's valuable or something, like aluminum or copper or something, the junk man is not going to recycle it for you. So, and just recycling it alone is not that meaningful, because even if it gets recycled, how much damage did it do to the environment, to wildlife, to people, right, when it was being made? it's the making of a product that causes the most problem, that's causing climate damage, right? It's not the disposal of the product, it's the making of it. So we want to make less stuff, and if we can do that, we can have a positive impact on climate and other things. So it's important that things last. At human scale, we think really long and hard about how can we make something that's going to last. We want to design something that's going to look relevant in 10 years and 50 years or longer. And if we do that well, things won't go out of style. They won't look dated. And that's something that we've always focused on. But we also have to make sure it lasts a long time, that the textile doesn't look worn after a while, that the arms don't get tattered. If we do that well, people will hold on to it and enjoy it for 20, 30 years. If we don't do it well, they'll throw it out after 4 or 5 years and buy another one. That's really not a good thing. We want to minimize that.
We're taking a quick break to remind designers about BenSolmani.com's newest West Hollywood Antiques Showroom launch, an artfully curated gallery of rare, exquisite rugs, including oversized pieces, to masterfully finish your project. Ben Solmani Antiques offers an exclusive concierge service to assist in choosing a timeless offering, providing photos, videos, or sourcing assistance. Visit BenSolmani.com or their West Hollywood showrooms to learn more. Well, you mentioned earlier that you weren't going to be making sofas anytime soon, but you are going to be far more focused on the residential space than you might have imagined you ever being. And I'm wondering, do you have an eye on any greater part of the home right now than you're currently serving?
We're very much focused on the home office, but we also have a whole line of chairs that are used in collaborative space in offices, that are used in conference rooms, many of which would look great in various parts of the home as well. We're developing a lounge chair. We've been working on it for many years. Niels Diffrient designed it. It's the most sophisticated lounge chair ever. It's really quite beautiful. It's still a year or so out, but I think it'll be a beautiful product for the home. You can make it kind of simple or sophisticated. We have there's a tray on it, for example, that you can put your computer on or your book or whatever. Or you can, instead of having a tray, you could just have a 34-inch touchscreen monitor, so that you sit down with your phone, you just dock your phone into a dock that's part of the chair, and now the 36-inch or whatever monitor is your phone. It's a touchscreen.
Really?
Yeah. So that sort of thing.
When is this coming?
Yeah. Well, unfortunately, it's over a year out, but it'll be cool when it comes.
So we're pre-orders.
So we're working on some cool stuff like that, which we actually started developing it 10 years ago. It's a long process.
How long a process is it? How long does the design and development process take in something like that?
We average 6 years to develop a chair. Other companies do it much faster, because a lot of companies just, they just have the same functionality of other chairs that they've had previously, and they just, restyle it. But we tend to start from scratch. So that takes a lot of time. So it takes 6 years. The lounge chair, it will probably be well over 12 years by the time we get it out the door.
And it comes at a time where you're just going to be so focused on this space, and it sounds like forevermore, much more focused on the residential space.
Absolutely. And look, the cool thing is, the residential space, it's a much larger market. It's yes. many times larger than the office market. So it's a very positive thing in a lot of ways.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it seems as if, as I say, it seems as if this is going to be the way the business goes for quite some time. And I don't know what is going to come of all of these enormous offices. I really don't. What do you think becomes of all of these huge office spaces in New York, in Chicago, in places like that?
No, that's a good question. I think people will come into the office. I think it's important that people do come into the office. So there'll still be offices to come to. But as we said, people are going to be also working from home. And I think that's a healthy thing. What I saw, I've been looking at office space in a number of cities, actually, including Chicago, is a lot of the new buildings that are just going up now are not like the traditional office buildings where you have 9-foot ceilings and that sort of thing. Some of these new buildings are very, very thoughtfully done, where the ceilings, we're seeing, 12-foot ceilings on every floor in some of these cases, where the lobby in a number of buildings is all open. And you walk in and there's this beautiful open lobby, maybe 30-foot ceilings, where there's a coffee shop in the middle, a fancy coffee shop, obviously, and places where you can have meeting rooms on the side that's all available for the tenants. And if you go to the top floor, you typically have a bar and seating and often outdoor seating as well that's there just for the tenants. So the real estate folks, they see what's going on as well.
Yeah.
Want to create a place where people will want to come to work.
How has all of that been going for you? And have you made changes to your own office space in a meaningful way? Or, I mean, I know the conversations about getting people back are complicated these days.
No, they are. We haven't made significant changes. I don't think many companies have. We're thinking about making significant changes and thinking about what those changes will be. And when we look at new space, we're making sure the new space is really cool and amazing. You know, we have a new office in New York. We're in the Grace Building in New York, and it's very high ceilings, all open, great lighting from one side of the building to another, so everyone has daylight. This is a trend that's been going on for a while. But I think the pandemic is accelerating it.
I really feel as though the office is going to need to offer people so many benefits that they don't have at home, so as to outweigh the fact that I am 10 feet away from my refrigerator right now, which I love, and I have all of these comforts at home. The office is really going to have to work overtime to win people back. Right?
That's absolutely right. And that's something that we've been doing. A lot of companies have been doing. We make sure we have healthy snacks everywhere. And it's not just us. So many companies are doing that sort of thing. Nuts and fruit are delivered every morning. And that sort of thing is it's going to become standard operating procedure, so that you always do have snacks around, or you can make a really good coffee. You don't have to run down the block and to find a coffee and stuff. So all of that's part of it. Absolutely.
Yes. A really good cup of coffee. I hope that Keurig machines are moved out and elaborate coffee makers are brought in to replace them.
We just ordered one. Yeah. We just ordered an elaborate coffee maker that grinds the coffee and grinds the bean. We just ordered one for our office here in New York. No, that's right. All that sort of thing matters. The details matter. In fact, in life, I've often found that it's the details that really matter. And whether you're designing something or just organizing your kitchen, the details matter a lot.
Well, they do. And that's why I think this, how designers are going to be thinking about this home office space, is going to evolve so much, because they are going to get much more into the details of all of this. And we're going to learn what else we need to make these spaces feel good and work well for us.
Absolutely. And then the other side of that is that what we're seeing in the residential side is that people are not as aware of the sustainability that's involved. And that's something that I think we're going to see change dramatically too, where people will start caring. Well, they do care. They'll start understanding the sustainable issues in their decisions. And that's a positive thing, because people take a lot of pride in that. And if they do the right thing, they take a lot of pride in saying that they did the right thing. But if you don't know what the right thing is, it's a non-issue.
Well, and it seems as if the commercial space was always well ahead of the residential space in terms of this whole sustainability movement and in terms of asking the right questions and understanding it. And now I think the residential space is finally catching up and understanding it better.
Yes. They have a ways to go, but they're definitely understanding it better. And that's very much a good thing. As I said, I think people do care deeply about protecting the environment. And I think now it's a matter of understanding what you can do that's really meaningful.
Do you feel anything good came out of Glasgow?
Well, I did read where India pledged to be climate neutral by 2070. So I thought that was great, except I think we'll be floating around in boats in New York City by 2070.
Way too late, right? Way too late.
I see these things, and it's just painful. Yeah, 2070. I'm sure they have not the faintest clue how they're going to get there in 2070. And anyone who's pledging will be long since retired in some mansion somewhere by 2070. No, I think it's unfortunate that we're not seeing a lot coming out of Glasgow. And that's why I think it's so important that the private sector has to act. The private sector has to do things that are meaningful. And I think we're seeing a tremendous amount being done by corporations and individuals around the world.
Well, I'm trying to stay positive on this subject, Bob, but it grows increasingly more difficult by the day, because without India and China, I don't see how we fix many of the environmental challenges that we face.
No, that's true. But we're seeing in our markets in China and India, we're seeing that the consumers there and the corporations there really do care about sustainability and do want to do the right thing and are actually willing to pay to get sustainable products in places like Shanghai and Beijing. So the will is there, the awareness is there. I'm just hoping that pushes their public sector, their government, to start making some of the right choices. There's more and more pressure there. I think that's what we have to do, is do the right thing and put pressure on governments to do the right thing as well.
Yes. And more long-term thinking. HumanScale's a private company and can think a lot longer term, can take 5-6 years to develop a new chair. And I feel that we've gotten very short-term focused, particularly with large publicly traded companies that have to answer every quarter for profitability, right?
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right, Dennis. We're seeing where public companies have to answer to their investors every quarter, and it's hard for them to make long-term decisions. Private companies are a very positive thing. There's actually fewer and fewer of them these days, unfortunately.
Well, and it seems to be so alluring to go public, and there seems to be this pot of gold on the other end of the rainbow that people think is there, but it completely shifts your priorities and your ability to think long term. And that's the biggest problem, I think, that we face, is that everyone is thinking so short term about these issues.
That's right. I think it's critically important to think long term, and only a handful of companies are. But the key is, though, that consumers can force even short-term companies to do the right thing. If consumers ask for ingredients labels, for example, or climate neutral, climate positive products, these large companies that are public will do the right thing, because they want to get the order.
Well, and that's what I would love to have designers walk away from with this conversation, is to a little bit better understanding of what to ask for and what to look out for, because as you say, that's what's going to start to move the needle in a meaningful way.
And again, I think a big part of it gets complex, but to keep it simple, ask for ingredients labels and make sure that there's healthy materials in the products. Not only healthy for people who are using them and for in your home, but healthy upstream and downstream, for people upstream, people downstream, but also for the planet upstream and downstream. And then you can actually get data from some companies about the carbon footprint of what you're buying. And the more people ask other companies for that, the more they're going to be forced to think about that and to reduce their carbon footprint.
There's so much to talk about around educating people, but I think this is a great start to help designers listening to this know a little bit more about how to think about it and what to ask for. And hopefully we can start to move forward with a greater urgency in our industry. So thank you for that, Bob. I really appreciate it. And I've so enjoyed our conversation.
No, thank you, Dennis. I love talking to you. It was a lot of fun. And I look forward to the next one.
I do too. Thank you again. A pleasure.
Thanks.
Thanks for listening. If you'd like to keep up with the latest design industry news, visit us online at businessofhome.com, where you can sign up for our newsletter, browse job listings, and join our BOH Insider community for access to online workshops, a free print subscription, and much more. If you have a note for the podcast, drop us a line at podcast@businessofhome.com. If you're enjoying these conversations, please leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. It helps others to discover the show. This show was produced by Fred Nicolaus and Caroline Burke and edited by Michael Castaneda. I'm Dennis Scully. Thanks again for listening, and I'll see you next week.